Now, let's give a warm welcome to our main speaker, Eric. My name's Eric, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know how to do this at all, really. Plus the fact that, I've only just started being able to speak again because about 3 weeks ago I had all my teeth taken out and these implants put in. And so it all kind of feels funny in there. And I'm just trying to kind of overcome this lift and a whistle, which you can hear. So, and actually, some of it is quite nice because I sound like people that I used to admire, like Otis Rush and Ray Charles, who used to sing with a lift. So that's cool. But one of the great things about this was that one of my dreads as a practicing alcoholic was dentistry. There was like a lot of other things that were really just not available to me. I had such the dysfunctionality in my life was so pronounced that I didn't even see a toothbrush until I was about 18. You know, I was very poor stuff, all that raised with, in a two up, two down, where there was an outside zinc bath and no bathroom. And so, but I remember being in class at school about 10 years old and the back of one of my front teeth fell off. And that's where a lot of my kind of disease started to kick in, because I started lying. And I think I've already kind of developed the thing that, Lauren and other people have talked about, that thing about changing the way I felt. I started changing the way I felt right then, and obviously before, because my teeth fell off because of sugar. And I started eating sugar. I can't even remember when I was probably 5 years old. Sugar on bread and butter. And that was like a post-war thing in England. That's what you did. Poor families did that. They used to put sugar in milk to feed the children so that the children would drink the milk. And it was kind of bad education, all kinds of just dysfunctionality. And so I was kind of set up. I was ready for this stuff. And there were so many other ways that it was coming into my life. I lived in a village in the country in England where we had this thing called the British Legion, which was like a veterans society, And I would see the ground. We would, as kids, would be taken and we'd be stuck outside, put outside with a packet of crisps or whatever you call them here, potato chips and a Coke or something. And they would go inside and they would change. The adults would change. And they'd go in kind of quiet and reserved and miserable. And you'd hear them changing inside into kind of happy, uninhibited, gregarious people. And they'd be having the time of their lives. And then they'd come out and then they'd be, once they were kind of out again and they'd take a phone, there would be a shift back somehow. And it would be a little bit more pronounced. It'd be a bit more kind of aggressive and sullen. It was kind of like, that was like a little microcosm of what my kind of drinking was like, that I would be, just shy, withdrawn, terrified, fear-based human being who once I got something inside of me became, anybody and was up for anything. And then as it started to wear off, I became malevolent and violent and aggressive and miserable and in the end suicidal. And that's what brought me here. And I the one thing that you always, that I go over and over in my head, and whenever I think about what I'm going to say at a meeting, is that apart from being blessed, I wonder why I was chosen for this and why we get to be chosen. I wouldn't even think about how that affects you, what you think about that. But I know for me, I don't understand why some people don't want it. I've done some 12-step work where I've brought people to the door and I've seen them turn away and walk away. And I've seen others die, deliberately die when confronted with the whole notion of getting honest and looking at their past and trying to do the work that is involved, and I don't understand why they didn't want to do it, and why me, why you, why we get to be fortunate enough to the miracle I'm talking about is the wanting. That's the miracle in my life, is that I wanted this enough to do the hard work, and I found it pain. I'm sure we've all found it pain. I'm sure the newcomers find it very, very pain. I can't even remember. That seems like a fog, like there's a fog between me now and where I was at then. That was... because I know I was just driven by fear. And like, I remember coming to meetings trying to impress everybody with the fact that I'd been around for a while. So, you know, how does a newcomer do that? You know, I wanted everyone, it was impossible. I wanted to pretend like I'd done the steps. I wanted to pretend like I was, you know, 3 or 4 years sober when I was only 6 weeks. And that, the pain of that, you know, the pain of that self-consciousness, of the pain of asking for help, that, to me, was very, very hard work. I don't know anybody who seriously works on this program who finds it easy, because it's not supposed to, because it requires that we put one foot in front of the other. And the most courageous people in the world, in my book, are recovering alcoholics, the people that walk through that door. And on a day, and that's still the same for me now, you know, driving up here tonight. I have to hand it over. I have to hand it over to my higher power, because, and that's easy for me now. I just say, you know, I don't know what to do. Get me there. I mean, I pray about like each mile of the road that I'm driving. Get me there safe. Get me something to eat. You know, let the people be nice to me. And try to keep me from talking about what I think. You know, because that is a complete waste of time. And they all know, you know, it's like we're all kind of experts on one fucking thing or another. But so, and you know, and I just hope that he, you know, sometimes he answers most of my prayers. He got me here. It's like, I think it was Ted said that, you know, that whole thing about, you know, I'm paying back. Because I prayed all through my drinking to be got out of every situation I was in, you know, to be relieved of this, to be got through that, and I'll never do it again, and I'd do it again, and I'd ask, and I was always delivered. Now, and that's the other thing, is why was I, and the thing is, you know, it really is none of my business. That's the kernel of it all, is that I don't think I'm supposed to know. And whether I think I'm supposed to know or not doesn't make a difference, because I'm not going to ever find out. You know, I don't think I will. It's only when I look back on the path that I've already travelled that I see how, when I've been there meeting that person, there's been some kind of connection where they meet another person that somehow brought to, you know, the program or something. And then I see that every girlfriend I've ever had, or every, you know, journey I've ever taken, has been in order for me to do some. It's all about service. And the thing is that I can't govern that. I have no control over it, and really all I've got to remember to do is just show up, and the rest is done for me. Because I don't, you know, the minute I try to figure out how this works, I don't need to come here anymore. And that's a frightening point, because I know people that do, and I guess I know some that do, and it's like I'm getting off on a tangent, and they turn into lecturers and they turn into experts. And I'm not, that's not what I want. I like to hear people that are, you know, around a long time and still say, well, I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know what, I'm frightened. Or, because then I know that they're human and I can, you know, because it's like, I'll go back to that thing of authority. I can't be around authority. I need humility. I need humility as an example. I need to see that someone can stay sober a long time and not become authoritative, not become, you know, like a governing body, not become an expert, that they can be, they can retain their innocence, that they can be childlike and still be adults, you know. And that's what I find that here. I don't find it anywhere else. And I know there are great people out there without programs who just seem to be on the path, and I do meet them from time to time. But if I want to be guaranteed for that kind of exposure, I come to an AA meeting and I get it here. So, my story is very, very simple. I just, you know, I'm just the same as everybody else here. It got hairy. It got good. I crossed the line. It got nasty. And someone, you know, and I don't, you know, was that whole thing about, I knew for a very, very, very long time that I crossed that line. I don't remember crossing it, but I knew for at least the last 10 years of my drinking, I think, that I had to stop. And I would, I remember getting, or waking up, coming to, and thinking, well, today is the day. I've got to stop this today, and I don't want to tell anybody about that, because I don't want to make any promises to anyone. So this is something I want to do on my own, and then when I've done it, I can say to somebody, look, I've stopped. But I'll just have a drink first to kind of like get there. so that my mind can function, you know, so that I can figure out how I'm going to do it. And of course, the first one wouldn't even go down. It would just be reject. My body would reject it, and I'd be dry heaving, and then it would be like, and it was vodka, you know, the door comes in the end, I'm sure. Most of us know that one. And finally, the third or fourth one would go down, and then I'd go, I'd be fine. And I'd think, right, now, so what should I, how would I go about this? I don't know. I'll take the bottle down to the other room, and I'd move around the house, you know. Postponing the actual whatever it was I thought I was going to do, postponing it until the bottle was empty, and I was passed out again. And you know, while I was doing that, I was thinking, well, this afternoon I'll stop, you know. And of course, this afternoon was gone, you know, and I'd wake up and it would be dark, and I wouldn't know whether that darkness was morning or evening. I mean, I didn't know. I'd be at home and I didn't know where I was, you know. And I was married, I had a very successful career, and this has been a great thing for me in my journey, was being able to tell people that acquisition is not it, because by the time I was 23 I was a millionaire. With the gift that God gave me as a musician, I was making money without wanting to make money. I didn't have to stop it coming in, and I tried very hard, believe me. And I would leave every band. The minute they thought they wanted to be on TV, I was gone. You know? There were some. The Anonymous Artist Program was very familiar, because somehow or another, I wanted that for me anyway. I wanted to be able to be good at something, but without anybody knowing it. But I did want them to know at the same. It was like that whole paradox of, I don't want you to know, but I want the kudos. And I had this madness, insanity even then. So, but, the whole thing about that was that I didn't want to be rich, I didn't want to be successful, and as long as I had that going on, I could not stop it. And I'm sure it's, you know, people that want money, want success, it just doesn't happen, because there's something, there's like a paradox in there. But I do know that having all that stuff, and having a beautiful wife and a great home and a career that just shone, you know, no matter what I tried to do to destruct the whole thing, it kept getting better and better. And in spite of all that, at the end of each day, I was considering suicide. And now, see, that, how does that make sense? You know, that, and I know that there are people who probably come into this program without very much, who think that this is going to get them that, you know. And maybe it will, but for sure, along with it come a lot of other problems, and some of those things I don't know if I'm ready for now. I mean, I'm still quite, you know, self-destructive. I mean, I do like to self-sabotage a lot. And I still practice that. I still kind of set about trying to undermine it. So that I can survive, really, and retain some kind of anonymity. So for that part of me, I'm very lucky and blessed in that I did, for instance, have a fairly strong belief in God when I came here. That was not a problem for me. And I did want to be anonymous. So when people came up to me at meetings and asked for my autograph, it was easy for me to say, no. You know, I'm Eric the alcoholic. And there was a time, I think, where there was definite conflict in it for me, that when I first got sober, which is a long while ago now, it was back in 1981, I went out on the road, you know, I went out on tour, and it sounded like shit, and it was an awful experience, and of course it was everything. I was in treatment, and everyone said, counselors and fellow patients alike said, you know, don't do anything, it's like that old thing, don't do anything, don't get involved with anybody, don't make any decisions, don't do anything for a year. And within 6 months I was touring America on a massive scale, hating every minute of it, and being around, very, very dangerous situations all the time, and really kind of feeling miserable. And I suppose, you know, I was on the way back, and I relapsed as a result of that. And I went back into treatment, and in that period of time, being back in treatment, I had to confront the idea that, you know, that was I was either going to come back here as an alcoholic above all, or I was probably going to die. You know, and this was, I mean, I have it in spades, this disease. I really do. I have it on every level. I mean, I project all the time. I'm a fear-based guy. I go to shame spirals at the drop of that. I'm getting better. Like Lauren said, I'm improving. But I don't do anything. I mean, all I do is I come to meetings and I pray that God will do most of the rest. I work the steps, but I'm very conscious of the fact that my defects are not really mine to control. I mean, I've never been able to, like someone else said, I don't know how to hand it over. I still don't know quite how to hand it over other than to try and help somebody else. You know, when I get into that predicament about self-obsession, I kind of got a switch where I think, well, think about somebody else. Don't do something to somebody else. That's my way of handing over. I don't know if that's the right, I mean, it's the way I do it. But for me, it's tough, you know, and the thing about where I've had to work very hard is being, you know, having this kind of celebrity as a musician and being like on the media and there's recently been a thing where I've put together a center in the Caribbean to help people, and I realize that's not an AA project. You know, I've had to kind of really work hard on my boundaries around this stuff. Is that, you know, treatment centers, I'm not AA. You know, that's like they work with the 12-step program and they advise, but nevertheless, you know, and it's still a separate issue. And when I was confronted with these people that, you know, that I'd put together to make this thing work, they said, well, you're going to go out there, have to go out there, and you're our only asset. Nobody knows this fucking thing is here. You've got to go and tell them that it's here. And you've got to, and, you know, in order to do that, well, I said, well, what am I going to do? I go on 60 Minutes, do the Today Show, I do, like, all kinds of fucking magazine and newspaper articles, and in the course of that, I'm on the edge the whole time of breaking my anonymity. And that's been a real tough thing, and, you know, that's given me, that whole exercise gave me a great learning curve about how important my anonymity is to me. And it is really about my boundary, about, you know, how much because now I've got to the point where I love this thing we have. I love it above all. And even when I say that, I can feel a tingle coming to me because it's a spiritual thing for me that what we do and the way we help other people and ourselves in the process is not to be fucked with. It is not to be compromised. Yeah. And I think, you know, and it's like, it's amazing how when people are faced with that, how it tantalizes people. You know, like, I remember my sponsor being involved in the kind of sort of business project where, you know, they had a long conference with these other people that he was involved with on some business thing, and it was all folding, it was getting crazy. And somehow or another, he sorted it all out. And after the meeting, one of these guys came up to him and said, you know, I don't know how you did that, and it was brilliant, but what's your secret? What have you got going on? And he said, well, it's nothing to do with me, and it is a secret. You know, that was like, that's what it... And I love that, you know, and that guy, you know, he's got 20 years, and he is like a saint to me, but he's one of those guys that says, I don't know, I'm going to just go to meetings, you know. And I love that. But it is very difficult. I've had to do a lot of work going to talk to people in treatment centers, saying, like, you know, that primary purpose thing, you know, when we read the preamble, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That is my primary purpose. And I've had to be known, my primary purpose is not making sure this fucking treatment center works. My primary purpose is if I get the opportunity going in there and telling the alcoholics in there, the recovering people that want to stay sober, my story, not what I think, or not, you know, please get your other pals to come in because we need the money, you know. But seriously, just to be there so that they can see that I'm a guy with a load of money who's had a great career but who still occasionally thinks about suicide, and, you know, although that got a lot better, I can assure you. But that is not it. That it is about peace of mind, which comes from other people, comes from our common welfare. And that's what I always rely on, you know, that in any given difficult situation, there's two options for me. One is to isolate and try and figure it out, and eventually fucking self-destruct and go down the road that I've already traveled. The other one is to come here and ask you for what you did when you had the similar experience. And that's the one I've chosen most. And it works. And it is usually, you know, I avoid people that try and, you know, proselytize or lecture or tell me what they think. I will say, well, tell me what you did when this happened to you so that I get the experience. And usually it is the simplest thing imaginable, you know. And that's what works. And so that's it for me. I mean, I flew all this way to come to this meeting, and I'm really glad to be here. I had no idea. I remember actually driving up the coast thinking that about 20 years ago I came up here to make a record at a place called Shangri-La, and man, is it different now? I mean, I don't know if it's still there, the place, but some of those guys are dead, you know. One of them's in the initial group called The Band, you know, that was a great band, and one of them hung himself, and he was like, we drank together. I mean, he was like a Grand Marnier freak. He drank Grand Marnier at the bottle, and I loved that. That's a man's way of drinking, you know. And he hung himself, and I thought, and I've seen so many people, lost so many friends, who didn't get this light shone in their lives, and which brings me back to that thing, is like God somehow or another chose us, and now we get to choose. And that's the other thing about this program that I love the most, is that I had a choice today. And like Lauren also said, I can look back and see that it's all been choice. And it still is, you know. I can choose. And I am responsible for my own happiness and for my own life. I'm totally responsible today. I don't blame anyone. I try to still on occasion, because I am an alcoholic, and I will always act in that typical way. My first response is usually to, you know, fuck it, it's his fault or her fault. And then I modify, and then I act. I act usually on the modification. For that I'm really grateful. It's been almost 12 years for me, and I guess I've got another 12 to go before I'll have paid back my debt, and I hope a bit more, you know. I don't ever really think about this as being a long, long road. It's still one day at a time for me. I really don't make too many plans. I try to take the program to everything I do, the way I love, the way I live, the way I work. It's about spontaneity and being in the moment. And we're very, very lucky to be given this gift. And I'm very grateful for you listening to me tonight. Thanks. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Casey. Please join me and give a warm Laguna Beach welcome to tonight's speaker, Tony from Palisades.
Hello, my name is Tony. I'm an alcoholic. This is a fun place. Alonzo said that the world is a safer place that we're all in here. Think what would happen if we all took a drink tonight. We'd take Laguna upon. I never drank like that before. Anyway, my name's Tony, I'm an alcoholic. It's funny how the mind works and how thinking works. I got sober December 29th, 1975, and the speaker that night was Chuck C, and he lived around here. and some of you I know knew him. And my life was transformed. My life has changed that night. All the newcomers, welcome. What happened to me was, I have no linear way of, I never know what I'm going to say. But when I came in here tonight, it all came back to me. Sometimes you go through patches. I go into patches where everything just becomes kind of even. And I came in here tonight, and I don't know why, but I heard it all over again, freshly, as if I was back almost 25 years ago. And I don't know what that's about. You're hearing the chapter 5 being read, the traditions, and seeing people coming up here. It reminds me back of the old days, because now I'm an old-timer. But I remember the heavy experience of when I came into AA that night, and I didn't want to come to all those numbers. But I came into that meeting on that night on the Pacific Palisades group, December 29th, it was a Monday night. And Chuck C was speaking that night, and there was another man speaking, was a doctor from Palos Verdes. And he looked like an alcoholic to me, and he sounded like an alcoholic. He said, "Man, the darn an alcoholic," and he sounded like, "Oh." Looked like something from The Lost Weekend. And I think he was a surgeon, he was a doctor, and I think he said his moment of truth was when he came to in the middle of an operation. And the theatre sister said, "No, Doc, you've got to sew her up, because he was going to operate again." And everyone laughed, and I thought they're all crazy, you know. But that's what got me sober, and laughter and fun. And I was swept away by this whole thing, because I wasn't a joiner. And the ironic thing is, whatever the higher power is, or God, whatever you want to call it, he, she, or it, ground of all being, collective consciousness, whatever it is, God, has a very strange sense of humor, because I never joined anything. I drank because I didn't like people. I drank because I didn't like crowds. I wasn't exactly a lone drinker, but I was a lonely person. I was a lonely man, and I kidded myself that I was a loner. My heroes were Humphrey Bogart and John Barrymore and all those people, and writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald all died of this chronic illness. Those are my heroes. And I thought they were very clever, and I thought I was clever. But the ironic thing was, being a loner and hating crowds, I never joined anything. I wouldn't join a club. And how should I get sober but just to be swept away by the crowd or by the mass enthusiasm of that first night when somebody got up and said, "My name is Chuck, I'm an alcoholic," and everyone said, "Hi, Chuck," and I was engulfed in this wave of life, because that's what it was. I'd been avoiding it all my life. Ever since I was a little kid, I felt like I was on an offshore island with a pair of high-powered binoculars looking at the mainland. You know, that was my life. I never joined an ending. I was born in South Wales. There's a good reason to be drunk. All the Welsh are drunks, you know. The Welsh were the Irish who couldn't swim. I had an idyllic childhood, you know, my first few years, and then I went to school. The age of 4, and I knew I was on the wrong planet, because I didn't know what they were talking about. I sat at the back of the class in my school. My whole school career, I had one expression on my face. That's how I viewed the world. I didn't know what was going on. All my life, until I came to this program, I heard my father say to my mother once in next door bedroom, he said, "There's something very radically wrong with this boy." Which isn't a way to encourage your son to grow up with confidence, you know. So I felt radically wrong. There's something wrong with me. I just probably was, as they say, maybe dyslexic or ADD or whatever these newfangled words are. I was just stupid. I was a dummy. Because I didn't know what they were talking about. I had no idea. My first encounter with God was from Miss Thomas, who was our school teacher, and she Peter said the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. I didn't know what she was talking about. When she's Our Father, I thought she'd been in heaven. I thought she'd died. And I didn't know what to make of this. And the Lord is my shepherd and all that stuff. And I remember going home, my father said, there's a load of rubbish. Don't believe in all that nonsense. And so he closed the door on my faith, because my father was a self-educated man, and he's a great character. He's a wonderful man. But he was an atheist, or so he professed to be. He was an agnostic or an atheist. He was what he called himself, a free thinker. He was a Marxist, and he believed in the revolution and all that. But he was angry all his life, and he's a wonderful guy. And I think, I know it's not traditional to say this about another person, but I think my father was an alcoholic as well. I think he was. Although his drinking patterns were different to mine. He would, no, they weren't that different actually. He was a periodic drinker. When he drank, he would go through that personality change and he'd become very nasty. Strange. And so I guess he was. And he died 19 years ago. And he died in pain and from heart disease. And he was a frightened man. But what happened to me, I grew up. I went through my life not believing in anything. And I was, because I was so slow at school, a friend of mine is here tonight and she says, don't call yourself dumb. Well, I just say that to get a laugh. But I think I was different and I couldn't grasp anything and I was educated into believing that I was pretty stupid. And maybe that's to do with the school or whatever, the society I lived in. And it was after just during the war years, and but I grew up very angry and very lonely because I couldn't fit anything together, and I felt like a failure. And all I had going for me was a kind of artistic streak. I loved music, and I could play the piano, and I used to compose, and I could write a little, and I could draw. You know, so I had an artistic streak, which, if you're in the rugby-playing, football-playing society, it doesn't go down well, you know. So I never played with the other kids. I was always on my own. And I remember identifying with this when I heard in my first few weeks in meetings in AA. I remember all my childhood standing on the corner of the street when all the other kids were down the other end of the street all playing games. And I used to stand there like this all afternoon looking at my thumbnails. And I used to do things like that, looking through my fingers like that. My father would say, where is he? My mother would say, he's at the end of the street there. He's a very strange boy, isn't he? What the hell is he thinking about? I didn't know I didn't think I was thinking about anything, really. I just didn't want to be with anyone. So being kind of rejected, I suppose, I'm not doing psychoanalysis on myself, but being rejected by other school kids, because kids can be very cruel, and I couldn't play sport, I couldn't do anything. And rugby is a national Welsh game. It's not like American football. It's a different game, but it's a rough and tumble game. And I couldn't play it. And I had to go out sometimes and play. But once I caught the ball, and all these guys were rushing towards me, I threw the ball up and ran off again. In a masculine society, that doesn't bode well. I see that. They called me a few things. And I used to play these dirges on piano and read poetry, which again doesn't go that well. And so I felt very rejected, which I probably was, and I rejected myself, and so I became more and more angry. And I felt like the village idiot, because that's the way I behaved. I started wearing the mask of being hopeless and helpless. And miraculously what happened, about the age of 17, I left school and I had nothing else to do, and I walked into a local YMCA place, you know, and they had an amateur acting group there, and I asked if I could join in, and I felt comfortable for the first time, and they put me on a stage, and I had a small part in this play, and I remember the first line, I was playing a disciple. It was about this time of the year, I think. I think it was a kind of Christmas play, and I remember I had one line, blessed are the meek, for they should inherit the earth, and I remember standing there thinking, I really fit in here. Sure beats working for a living, I thought. So I decided to become an actor. And I studied, I went to college for a few years, and I did what you call the draft here. In England, it's called National Service. I went in the army for 2 years, and I came out in 1960. I'd been at all afflicted by alcoholism as such. I never really was a heavy drinker. I had a few beers on a Saturday night, but I didn't have the money to afford that much. And so I didn't get into any trouble, but I felt I'm talking about being in the military service. I mean, I felt really on the outside, but I was charmed. I had this knack of falling on my feet, like just like a cat. And I had this job as a clerk in the main office there, and I couldn't type, I couldn't do anything. I didn't know how I stayed in this job. The guy who gave me the job used to look at me with a kind of puzzled look, like, how the hell did I give you this job? You can't do anything. Sometimes I'd be sitting there and typing away, and and I'd turn around and he'd be looking at me like this. How did you get slipped through? So I was very lucky. Anyway, I came out of the army and then I became an actor and I did some more training and I got some jobs in repertory companies and all that. And then in 1960 my drinking started to take a grip of me and I remember being ill and I would buy anyone a drink just to win some friendship because I felt so odd. And I knew that they were all laughing at me. I was classically paranoid, but what I was really was alcoholic, chronic alcoholic, in its earliest stages. And in the early 1960s, I started getting into trouble with it. But I became, in a very short period of time, in about 5 years, I became lucky. I was lucky. I got some pretty good jobs, and I started working in London, in the London Theatre. National Theatre, and I was given some pretty good stuff to do, and I didn't trust anyone, and I thought, what's their angle? Not realizing that they were giving me a gift, that they were giving me work, because they thought I was talented. But I suspected everyone, and I would turn around and bite the hand that fed me. And I was told about my drinking, I was warned about it by the big cheese there. It was a guy called Lawrence Olivier, and he was running this theatre, and I was in it, and I was trouble. And he said to me, he said, why are you doing this? He said, you know, you're a talented guy. He said, what are you doing all this for? He sent me to a psychiatrist. And he paid for one session with the psychiatrist. And I was told by the psychiatrist that I was suffering from some kind of creative tension. Called creative stress. Being an actor, you know, I thought, well, yeah, of course. I said to my wife, I'm suffering from creative stress. She said, uh-huh. And so, you know, another bottle of wine. I remember I was married, my first marriage was a disaster, mostly my fault, and after that marriage was produced a little girl, and I left my wife after 2 years, I couldn't take any more of it, we were both crazy. And then I met my second wife, and we used to go out, and my second wife was a typically non-alcoholic, and she's a very nice, decent woman, very reasonable, and I say this with all respect, not making any judgment at all. But she is different, and the non-alcoholics in this room are different to us. We'd go out, and I'd have, I said, would you like a glass of wine? She said, yes, I'd like a wine. She'd have a glass of red wine, and so I'd order 2 bottles. She said, but you want 2 bottles? I said, well, yeah, 2 of us. She said, but, you know, I don't want a bottle. I said, why not? She said, well, I don't need it. Well, I'll drink it then. And she used to do those weird things. And I say this all due respect, because I love non-alcoholics as well. I like non-alcoholic people. They're fascinating. They're as weird to me as I am to them. I've been in the restaurant with them, you know, and with my non-alcoholic friends. And I said, do you want a bottle of wine? Or, you know, I like buying, you know, making people have a good time. If they want to drink, fine. And I watch the way when the waiter comes up and they pour a little drop and they do this. Very nice. And they smoke cigarettes. They don't even inhale it. So. And I watch my wife, you know, she 6 o'clock every night, she has a little glass of wine, and it's on the table for about an hour. I can't take my eyes off it. And sometimes she says, didn't I have a drink? Somebody says, yes, on the kitchen table. I know exactly what it is. Why would anyone leave it on the table? Mine was chained to my wrist. I remember after I got sober, in fact, I came back, I was in New York, and I was flying back. I've been working on something in New York, and I was flying back to Los Angeles, this way, way back, 1976, 77, somewhere. I've seen the thing there, and maybe it was a Thanksgiving, I don't know, maybe it was a special day, but this, what do you call them, the flight attendant, she looked like one of us, she probably was. She was passing this champagne out, filling people's glasses with champagne. I had an orange juice or something, and I was reading the book, and I was newly sober, maybe I'd been sober about a year, and she came up and she said, would you like to drink the champagne? I said, no thanks, not for me, no. I'll have an orange juice. She said, come on, just a little champagne. I said, no thanks. She said, why not? I said, well, I have to report for work next month. And I don't know how that came out of my mouth. And she said, huh? I said, I've got to work next month. She said, I don't understand. I said, no, do I. And I don't understand to this day. Why? I love drinking. For the alcoholic who is out there, the new one, tonight, I love booze, and I'm glad I drank. But I'm not going to be puritanical and say, you know, I hate booze. I love booze. I loved alcohol. And it did great things for me in the early years. It got me into scrapes. It got me in a lot of trouble. But it also got me through things. It gave me a lot of confidence. And I did some things which weren't all bad. You know, some of them were good. And it gave me a kind of confidence, but it also gave me a lot of fuel for my rage and anger. And I became more and more angry as the years went by. And, of course, I drank to quell the anger and to deaden the anger and deaden the feelings, but of course it made me more and more angry. I mean, I could empty an entire room. I'd go to a party, I could insult everyone. And I've done it. I did it. People would walk out, good night, you know. I'd say to my wife, what happened? She said, don't you remember? I said, no. You insulted everyone in the room. I said, did I? She said, you can't remember? I said, no. And then about the mid-1970s, I was, one morning, I was very hungover, and I heard on the radio about this weird thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard about alcoholism, and I heard a woman being interviewed. She said, yeah, I drank for many years, and she said, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. This was on British BBC radio. And she said, I got sober, and I haven't had a drink since. She said, it's an illness. I thought, isn't that sad? That's sad. What is it like to be an alcoholic? And I was doing a television play, I remember, and I was playing an alcoholic in this television play, and I had lines like saying, I'm a dipsomaniac, I'm an alcoholic, and I loved these lines I was speaking. I said, I'm an alcoholic. It sounded so rich. I didn't realize that I was one. And in this play, I remember it's called The Arcata Promise, and in this play, I say to this woman I'm with, I said, I can leave the drink, it's when the first one starts. Then I've got to have drink more. And I said to the actress I was working with, I said, this is me. It must be terrible to be an alcoholic. But what I was doing was 12-stepping myself in a way. I was being gotten ready for this program. And then I came to America in 1974. And to New York. And I was doing a production in New York. And it was September. It was just after Watergate, I remember. And I remember arriving in New York and feeling I'd come home. And I always wanted to come to America, and I dreamed of coming to America, and I dreamed of sitting in the American bars, and, you know, because I'd seen all the movies, and I was raised on American movies. I'd watched them all, drinking Humphrey Bogart and all that smoke, and, you know, I loved it all. It was fantastic. And I couldn't wait to get there, and I came to New York, and I remember the first morning when I woke up, I was pretty drunk, pretty hungover, and I looked down Fifth Avenue, and there was the Empire State. I thought, I'm home. And I knew I'd come home. I knew as clearly as anything that I'd come home, and I never had to go back to England, and I didn't want to go back. And there's nothing wrong with the country, but I just didn't want to go back. I didn't fit in anymore. And I was already becoming quite a successful actor, and the ironic and weird thing was happening. I was drinking more because I was more and more unhappy. If there's a parable in this success and all that stuff doesn't make you happy, and I learned that the hard way. I wasn't happy. I was deeply unhappy. But I couldn't figure out why, because I wanted to be successful in my job, but I was deeply ashamed of myself and deeply guilty and terrified. And I discovered the magic of the American bars. You never seem to close down here. You know, they open all night. They were in New York anyway. I used to go to a place called Charlie's and Jimmy Ray's. God. They were terrible places, but they were wonderful at the time. And I used to go over there and I'd drink and drink until I fell out of the bar stool. But I used to have a head full of wonderful knowledge because I was self-educated, because I wasn't too bright at school, but I read books. I used to know things that nobody else knew. I knew distances and light years of our nearest galaxies, and I knew all that stuff. But I'd get lost in the bathroom. So all the knowledge I had didn't get me anywhere. I used to quote Nietzsche, and I'd never read Nietzsche. I used to quote Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer, I used to make up things that Schopenhauer was supposed to have said. Never even read him. One book I did profess to read was Carlos Castaneda's Teachings of Don Juan, but I never even read him. In fact, that's what got me sober, because I was on my way to New Mexico to find that peyote, but I never got there. And I was working in this play, and there was a woman called Mary. She's dead now. Her name is Mary Doyle, so I'm not breaking her. Indeed, she used to call herself Mary Doyle. And she had a wonderful Irish sense of humor. She used to laugh at all my stupid jokes. I know she had this spirit about her, and she was a real program of attraction. She seemed to be warm-hearted, and she had this great laugh, and I know she smoked, and I thought, oh, what a wonderful woman she is. And somebody told me, they said, you know, Mary's an alcoholic? I said, really? They said, yeah, and she's never drunk. They said, no, she's an Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, oh, that's really sad. I thought, well, no wonder she smokes a lot, because she'd have to do something. And she used to smile at me, you know, that AA smile. Hi. How are you?
Fine.
Okay. She used to come over to the bar with me sometimes, and she'd have a coffee, and I'd sit there, and I said, would you like a beer? She said, no. I said, well, oh, because you don't drink at all? She said, no. She just used to whisper, she said, no, and she'd look pitiful at me, and, you know. So this went on, and towards the end of the run in New York, in 1975, it was in the summer of 75, and I was about to leave New York and come over to California. I had some work to do here, and I was in a party, and I was so smashed that night. And I think I'd smoked a bit of glass, and I wasn't into that. I'm just a drunk. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict, really, because that's all it is another form of narcotic. But I was so smashed that night in such bad shape, and I asked Mary if she would help me. So we went out the next day, and we had lunch, and she described to me the nature of alcoholism, that it is, in fact, an illness. I thought, well, that's interesting. And she said, it's threefold, mental, physical, and spiritual illness. Spiritual, I didn't want to know about that. And she said, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. Well, that's very insulting to a man of my supreme intelligence. If you don't take the... My little child knows that. So she said, would you like to come to a meeting? I said, no. I'll do it myself. Typically, having asked if she would help me, I turned her down when she offered the help. And she said, fine. That's okay. Maybe you're not an alcoholic. She knew damn well I was, but she used to talk about me to her husband every night about how I'd, you know, fallen down on stage and all that. Not exactly fallen down. But I did, for 6 weeks, stay dry. And in that period, I think something happened to me. Now, whatever this design is, this divine intervention, whatever it is that God has done or whatever, I was very comfortable in those 6 weeks. I was very comfortable. I felt fine. I had no craving. I thought, that's it. Like Bill W. in the book says, you know, the goose hung high, and I self-knowledge, that's all I needed, and I was in great shape. I was drinking gallons of Tab or Diet Coke, as the Tab is called, as I smoking cigarettes, but I thought, well, fine, I had another drink. Ah, got it. Can't be an alcoholic. 6 weeks, that's as much as I could ever manage. 6 weeks dry. But this time I wasn't white knuckle. I felt fantastic. I had energy. Energy and power and all that. I was working well on stage, and you know, everything seemed fine. People remarked on the difference. They said, God, you look so well. I was, wow, fantastic. Energy. I was like a stormtrooper. I would walk down the street and ba-bam. The ego and the arrogance, you know, I haven't made. I used to look at Mary with such pity. I thought, those poor woman. She just nodded me. And then the last night in New York, I went to a party, and It was like a farewell, goodbye party for me, and I was going off to California with my wife the next day. June 1975, and there's a big drinks table, full of booze, full of alcohol, and I thought, well, I've got a Diet Coke here, whatever I was drinking, and I thought, well, one whiskey won't hurt, and yeah, just a little drop in there. And don't remember any more that night. Got on the plane next day, flew to California, feeling very ashamed, dehydrated, really hungover, bad that way, I always had the shakes, and I tried another few days, dry. 4th of July, I went to a party, and I thought, well, you know, I tried the same thing, I was about to pour another drink, and somebody said, this friend of mine, she said, don't take that drink, and I wanted to kill her, you know, I would have taken her head off, because she got in my way. And what happened was I was working on a TV thing and TV film, and this woman I was working with, she was at the end of the day, we were in Century City, and it was cocktail hour, you know, the beautiful long shadows of the evening sun coming, and a wonderful time, which is the best time for alcoholics. And she had a paper cup or a polystyrene cup and some ice in it. She said, do you want a drink before you go home? I said, no, I'm going to go home. She said, well, just one ice. No, I think I've got a bit. I'm trying to, you know, give it a break. You know, I'm trying to knock it on the head. I think I've got a bit of a problem. She said, okay. I said, well, what is it? She said, tequila. I love tequila. Because it unzipped my mind. And tequila got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Tequila was my best friend because I hallucinated on it and I started getting quasi-religious. Yeah, visions. I saw Jesus walking on Malibu Beach. And he's down in Palm Springs and the stones down around Idlewild were talking to me and I was talking about them. And I talked to the beach and when I went through the Milky Way and back. I looked at the stars one night. I was up in Malibu, up in Trancas, and I looked at the stars. And I went right through the Milky Way and back. It was only that close to the Milky Way, and all the stars came out. And I told this person I was with, I said, you know, the stars are really very, very near. She said, oh, really? Okay. And anyway, what happened was I started losing. So I drank that tequila that night, and 6 months later, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had the worst roller coaster. It was the worst time and the best of times. I was a menace to work with. I was trouble to work with. People didn't trust me, and I'd turn up in the morning and for work, and people would look at me, hi, Tony, how are you doing? Okay, and they'd give me that look, you know. And I heard somebody say to the cameraman once day, he said, we better get him before lunch because he's just fooling around. I said, who are you talking about? They said, you. Because I wasn't fit for anything. And yet, the director said to me, he said, why are you doing this, Tony? You know, you're so talented. Why? It's up to you, but why? They gave me that lecture. You know, why are you doing this? Don't you think you should cut down a bit? And I was given those lectures. You know, Tony, it's such a shame you're going to kill yourself, your liver and everything. You're going to kill yourself. What I was more scared of was the driving. I used to get in my car and drive over the canyons and I didn't know where I was going, and I would never remember the next day where I had been, and I checked the front of the car to see if there were any dents or any blood or anything like that, because I didn't know I could have killed someone. But the police never caught me. I hope no policeman didn't happen. They never caught me. I was so lucky they never caught me. And I should have been thrown in the slammer many, many times, and I wasn't. I was just lucky I got away with it. And what happened in the Christmas 75, my wife took off for England to see her folks. And I took her to the airport, and I said to her, I think I'm an alcoholic. She went very cold on me, because she said, well, maybe you are. It's up to you. And that hurt. And I dropped her at the airport, and I got out the car to let her out of the car. I said, well, have a good time in Christmas. She and you. And she walked away. And I watched as she walked into that arrival area, or the departure area, and I thought, well, I think I've lost everything. I finally kicked out everything. All my friends have gone. I'm kicking everything out of my life. It's like I'm pushing away the very feast of life. And I got back to my apartment and I was very depressed. And a couple of days later, I drove down to Palm Springs. I drove down to Arizona. I was on my way, really, to Santa Fe. I wanted to go down to New Mexico. I wanted to find Carlos Castaneda. I wanted to find that peyote because Moose wasn't working for me anymore, and I wanted to find those magic mushrooms, or whatever they were, and peyote. And I got as far as Phoenix, and I stayed in some crummy hotel, and I sat there in that bar that night. It was Christmas Eve, and I sat there. God, I just remember this. Yeah. 25 years. I sat in that bar, and they had an old-fashioned jukebox. And I kept putting the quarter in the jukebox, whatever it was, and I kept playing Neil Sedaka's Solitaire. And the Boats and Chains, back rack song over and over again. And I remember these two big guys sitting on the bar, and he's going to put the same... Hey, it's a mister, can you change the tune? I said, don't you like it? Yeah, but not 15 times. Come on. I went up to my room, and I felt the despair and loneliness, and I decided I was going to become a country western singer. I don't know why you think that's funny. Another great song was Tom T. Hall's Little Children. Watermelon, the old dogs, Little Children, Watermelon Wine. That was my favorite. It's great. And Billie Holiday, of course. Billie Holiday. But anyway, I went down into my hotel room and I wrote on a piece of paper, I found myself in Phoenix, Arizona. I thought that would be good. Chris Christopherson or Tom T. Hall could sing that. I get around to writing that and I put the piece of paper on top of the cupboard. Now, why put it up there? Nobody would find it. It's probably still there. But I think I was sending a message to myself. And next day, I phoned my wife in England, and it was early morning their time. And I said, Happy Christmas. She said, and you? Where are you? I said, in Phoenix, Arizona. Oh, well, have a good time. She put the phone down, and that was it. I thought, well, I've really lost everything. The one person I could trust in my life has gone. And she trusted me, she put everything she could into this marriage, and I just destroyed and betrayed everything. And I felt that deeply, and I drove back, made my way back to Los Angeles, and it was December the 27th, 75, and I sat in my apartment in Wilshire Boulevard, and I had everything going for me. I had a career, and I had, don't think I had a wife left anymore, but I was losing my life, and I was aware of it. I got another bottle of tequila, and I sat in that apartment, and what is that time? The Prater song, It's Twilight Time Again, or whatever it's called, I don't know. And I felt the loneliness that I guess we all feel at that point of desperation. And the phone rang, and I was invited to a party, and I went to this party up in Holmby Hills, and I sat under the piano most of the evening, which is not a place for a social drinker, but that's why I sat. And I made trouble, and as I, a friend of mine was an agent, and he said, come on, Tony, it's time you went home, and they stood me on the doorstep of the house, and I remember vaguely some people saying, is he okay? And they were talking about me, and I said, I've lost my car. Somebody's stolen my car. They said, no, they didn't, nobody's stolen it. You left it in the middle of the street with the lights on, and we saw you and rescued you, and your car's back in the apartment. We took it back, and we brought you here for your own safety. I said, I don't remember anything of that. I said, well, you did. I said, no. I said, one thing I do know is I'm an alcoholic and I develop very fast. And something went on, the light turned on inside me, and I looked up at the trees, those eucalyptus trees, and I thought, somebody up there really likes me. I thought of a movie with Paul Newman, somebody up there likes me, and I thought, somebody up there likes me, because I should have died years ago. I should have been killed, or I could have taken out a whole family in a car, you know, in a car smash, an auto smash. And I said this fellow, I said, I need help and I need to phone Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went up to his house and he got me the number. And I stayed there, I slept on this sofa, I think. And I, next day he dropped me at my apartment and he said, well, good luck. And I didn't bother to phone AA, I didn't think it would be open on Sundays. But I waited until the Monday morning and I phoned AA, and it was the Western, it was the West End sort of branch office of, it was in Westwood Boulevard then. And I phoned and I said, and this woman said, hi, Alcoholics, can I help you? I said, yeah, my name is Tony, and I think I'm an alcoholic. And this very nice elderly voice of a lady, she said, okay, honey, can we come and get you? I said, no. I said, I'm at the end of my rope. She said, well, that's beautiful. I said, I'm finished, I'm washed up. No, that's great, just great. I said, I want to, she said, I said, where are you? I said, I'll come in and see you. So I got the address and I took my car, my poor battered car, after this long journey from Arizona, and I parked it just south of those old railroad tracks they used to have then on Santa Monica Boulevard. And I started walking up that way and Westwood Boulevard, and I thought, maybe I'm making too much of a big thing of this. You know, I'm an actor after all, and yeah, maybe I'm melodramatizing this. And another voice in me went off like a little whisper, says, just get to the place and do something for yourself for once. Don't be such a jerk. And I went into this office, and it was up the stairs, I think I remember, and I expected to see a bunch of old people in rags holding on to each other. But I thought what it was, I really thought that, you know, Joe would say to Doris, okay, Doris, you can drink tomorrow now, we'll come up with you and make sure you don't drink too much, and then it's my turn tomorrow. I had no idea. And I walked into this office, there were no drunks lying on the floor, it was just a nice, clean, pine wood little office, and this nice elderly lady called Dorothy, I came in and I said, my name's Dorothy. Hi, honey. And I thought, oh, I'm in with the Christian Brigade now, and tambourines, you know, and Salvation Army. And that's wonderful, but I didn't want any part of it because I hated Christianity and church, whatever it is to do with worship. And I sat down, she gave me a coffee, she said, and she described the nature of alcoholism. She came up with that same stupid phrase, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. I said, these people are simpletons. And she said, give me your phone number and, you know, and I'll get somebody over to see you and they'll phone you and take you to a meeting. I said, meeting? Yes, a meeting. I said, is it religious? She said, no. I didn't know why I was calling because I'd already seen Jesus walking on Malibu Beach. I'd been through the Milky Way. I'd seen the angels sing. And so, as I got up to go, she said the most astounding thing. She sprung the terrible three-letter word on me. She's a little woman, little lady, her name is Dorothy, and she said, why don't you just come home and rest, honey? And I looked at her and I started feeling this terrible, I thought I was going to cry. But she said, it's like those swallows coming home to Capistrano. She said, why don't you come home and rest? I thought, I've been out there so long, I'm so tired, I'm so weary, I'm so fed up with everything, I'm so desperately lonely. And then she said something which is really terrible. She said, why don't you just trust in God? And at that moment, the gates opened, and something happened, and I grabbed hold of her, because I knew within a split, there's like a fast-forward microchip, zoom, right through my life, zoom, backwards. I thought, everything I've tried has failed. I thought, why not? G-O-D. And I sat in churches, looking at stained glass windows, and wondering what it was all about, and I walked down on the street in Westwood Boulevard, it was probably about 10 o'clock in the morning, and beautiful sunny morning, and everything brightened up, and this big, powerful voice, wraparound sound, said, it's all over, and now you can get on with your life, and it's all been for a purpose, so don't forget one moment of it, now go about your business. And it was that clear. And the craving to drink left me at that very moment, it's never come back. So I take it at that moment I came in contact with a power which is so fascinating and so infinite and so all-consuming. I was taken to my first meeting that night and a man called George picked me up. He phoned me up and said, my name is George, I'm an alcoholic. And he picked me up. He slammed the phone down once he got the address. I thought, damn, I can't stop him coming. I'm in the third angle. I walked down, there was George, real alcoholic, son of a bitch. Hi! Shook my hand, broke my hand. My name's George, I'm an alcoholic. His girlfriend, Lila, she chewed gum on. Hi, honey. We're all here tonight. We're all here. And they sat in that car. I sat in the back and they didn't shut up from the moment we left Westwood until we got to Palisades. I thought I'm really in with the cuckoo birds. And I was taken to my meeting and I sat in the chair between these two people, Bob and George, and that got Don.
You must not hold on.
He had a voice like a truck, and he looked like he'd been dragged by a truck on his feet. He was the surgeon, and the other man was Chuck C., and he said, man, Chuck, I'm an alcoholic. I'll be sober by the grace of God 30 years this January, but he must be brain dead. How can anyone? And I was taken up to see him after the meeting, and I thought, and as I sat there, I thought, I've come home. I sat in that room that night, and there's a big room, and in All Saints Church, Corpus Christi Church, and They must have said things, and I sat in that room and I thought, I know I've come here, I've come finally come home, because all my life, for 37 years, I felt like the outsider. I knew that everyone sitting in that room, rubbing shoulders with each other, we were all the same, and that we all felt the same, like we were the outsiders, we were the damned, we could never get our act together. And somebody said to me that night, they said, you need never try to get your act together, you never will. These two men took me out the next day. I wouldn't wrap up in any second. I went out the next day with these two men, and they discussed it over lunch, and I said, I feel so inadequate. And one of them said, have you ever thought of the fact that you are inadequate? I said, no. They said, well, you are. You have no power. And it made such total sense. I have no power. I'm powerless. And I have no power of prediction. I can't tell you what's going to happen in the next 3 seconds. So I'm going to shut up any minute. But I tell you that it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. And it's the simplicity that's got to me. I mean, I don't do half the things that I'm told other people do. But I can't describe to you what it's like to not want to drink, to not have any desire to drink, and to get up in the morning. And I don't, I get up in the morning, I go to meetings, and I go to early morning meetings most of the time, and I get to at least 5 meetings a week to keep me comfortable. And people say, I still go to those meetings every year. Why? Because I'll die if I don't. They say, oh, come on. I say, no, I do. So I don't explain. I don't have any arguments with people who are not alcoholics. I don't try to explain the problem. But that's what's happened. I keep it simple, and I have a lot of fun with this. And that's it. I can't discover. I can't examine things. I can't analyze the big book. I can't sit around being scholastic about it. I know some people are experts on it. I've tried that, and I can't do it. I don't have that mindset because I'm a dummy, and I'm not too bright. So I can't examine this. But all I do is get up in the morning and go to bed at night, say, much obliged, thanks a lot. See you in the morning. Go to sleep. It's incredible. I should have been dead years ago. I should have been playing the fortunes of psychoanalysts to get this sorted out. And I've come here for free, fun and for free, cost me $1 to put in the basket. It's the best education, $1 million education, $1 at a time. And I've had the best life I can't describe it. People do ask me, so what's life being so much? I couldn't even begin to tell you. How does AA work? I said, very well, thanks.
Thank you.
Happy Christmas.